Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. I'm James Serene, Bicom's CEO. We have two guests this week. First of all, I'm delighted to be joined by Brigadier General Michael Herzog, who is a fellow at Bicom. And Mike, if I could just start by asking you about what you thought of the escalation between the US and Iran and the US non-response to that shooting down of the drone.
Well, we've seen a series of Iranian measures, actually provocations, exiting the previous status quo once the U.S. Escalated its own so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and applied more sanctions against Iran. So Iran, beginning 2 months ago, took a series of violent measures against Iranian American interests and allies in the region, against Saudi oil facilities, against tankers, firing rockets in the direction of the American embassy in Baghdad and other American deployments in Iraq, and ultimately shooting down a U.S. drone. And what we see on the other side is the U.S. Relying heavily, almost exclusively, on economic sanctions against Iran, carrying out a cyber attack whose effectiveness is not clear yet, but shying away from any other type of response, including the employment of military tools. And the impression that comes across is that the U.S. is kind of, you might use the term, deterred from applying military tools for fear of escalating into war. I mean, President Trump and people around him continuously say that the U.S. does not want war. But again, the message that comes across in our part of the world, here in the Middle East, is that the U.S. Is unwilling to provide the military backbone to its own sanctions against Iran, and that may encourage Iran to continue and push the envelope, provoke more and more, and raise the stakes of brinkmanship against the U.S. and U.S. allies in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Israel. My concern is that if that persists, the Iranians are encouraged to continue and escalate, at one point they will miscalculate, and then the U.S. may respond violently, but then it may respond, it may overdo it, may overreact in a way that leads to the very undesired escalation that the Americans fear now, and that is a source of concern. I think when you play this game of brinkmanship, and you have to play it on both sides, and obviously you want to avoid war, you have to play a game of escalation management and look at the range of options that are in between either war or nothing. And there's a huge range of options, certainly for a superpower like the United States. And if I may add, Israel is taking action, actually run a campaign against Iranian military entrenchment in Syria, in our own neighborhood. And for the last 2.5 years, Israel has carried out hundreds of strikes against Iranian targets in Syria without escalating into war. So there is a way of managing such a campaign, or carrying out escalation dominance, mastering escalation dominance, that I think could be applied also in the case of the US and Iran.
There's a real contrast here. I mean, I've heard you talk about this. The US is very, very comfortable using its economic muscle. It's very, very comfortable using its dominance of the, you know, world financial system, the dollar, to be able to put huge pressure on Iran and come up with a whole range of options, whether they be blanket sanctions, very targeted sanctions. They're very, very comfortable doing that. But like you say, they're very uncomfortable doing something similar with military assets. For them, it's either, like you say, in this option, it was either they were going to bomb the launchers that fired missiles at the drone, or there was going to be nothing. Now, how would you explain the reluctance to do some of the things that you suggest, or maybe the lack of sort of a willingness? Is it just a belief that any action, however small, leads very quickly to escalation because it will be clear the US has done it? How would you describe that reluctance?
Well, I believe that there's some fatigue in the US when it comes to talking about potential wars in the Middle East. Having fought wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, having invested heavily. The U.S. is now focused on other areas in the globe, in the Far East, China, North Korea, and so on. And as President Trump keeps saying, invested billions in the Middle East without getting any return. So there is a general atmosphere in the United States, both in Congress and publicly, and inside the administration, that the U.S. should shy away from war. However, being a global power, the U.S. cannot just deny itself the ability to use such tools, again, without escalating to war. When you use a military tool, doesn't mean you escalate to war. And look at what Israel did against Iran in Syria. But there is, as a result of this experience of the United States in the region, developed this general mindset that if we take military action, let's say against Iran, we will necessarily escalate into war. That mindset characterized the Obama administration, and I believe it characterized the Trump administration as well.
Yeah.
And my argument is that there is a whole range of options in between which could deter Iran without escalating to war. And the U.S. certainly, as a superpower, can certainly deter Iran. It doesn't make sense that Iran is more, that the U.S. is more deterred than Iran.
And the failure of that deterrence, in a way, that if Iran has felt that it sort of got away with what it's been doing recently, is able to keep upping the pressure, what do you think the failure of that deterrence could potentially lead to?
Well, if Iran decides to further provoke and up the ante, I think you could see possibly some action against Israel as well, from either Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, or elsewhere. Further provocations in the Gulf, and that in itself raises stakes of brinkmanship and possibility of ultimately escalating to the undesired war. If you do not want to escalate to war, you have to play escalation management. You have to show the other side that you are not going to blink first, that you are willing to go very far, and that deters them.
Thank you very much, Mike. That was fascinating. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd now like to introduce Anshul Pfeffer, a Haaretz journalist, economist, Times correspondent in Israel, and also Bibi Netanyahu biographer. Anshul, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, James.
You wrote an article this week where you sort of did the thing of trying to shoehorn Israel into the saga that was going on in London about the resignation of the British ambassador to Washington and examining the special relationship. But you had an interesting angle where you sort of said, actually, the Israel-US special relationship isn't so special and is very, very personal too. Could you give us a bit of an insight into that?
Well, I think you can obviously shoehorn Israel into every debate in London now. But I think, you know, when we're talking about special relationships between countries, especially the special relationship between the US and the UK, then we're talking really about myths, because as we know, there have been ups and quite a lot of downs, you know, between Washington and London since the special relationship ostensibly was cemented in the Second World War. And, you know, I speak to a lot of diplomats, both based here in Israel and sometimes visiting here in Israel, and they're talking now about Israel having a special relationship with the United States. And obviously everyone talks about Donald Trump being the most pro-Israel president ever and stuff like that. And I think what we're missing is that, especially with Trump, but obviously with lots of leaders, the relationship isn't so much between countries. It hinges in many cases, not all, and, you know, we can talk about places where actually leaders don't get along personally and the countries still have a relationship. But under Donald Trump, his administration's relationship with countries usually hinges on a personal relationship with the leader of that country. And that's especially true of his relationship with Israel and with Benjamin Netanyahu.
And what's the background to that? Why was Bibi able to create such a personal relationship? I mean, it goes back many years, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's one of the main points. You know, Donald Trump is not someone who is disposed to foreigners. You know, he doesn't like things that which are unfamiliar to him. He doesn't enjoy foreign travel. He's not, so, you know, he doesn't speak any other languages besides English. He's not a foreign policy president in any sense of the word. And you know, we've seen his disdain and often hostility to U.S. allies and to organizations which the U.S. has historically either been part of, like NATO, or had an important relationship with, like the European Union. We've seen how anti-EU and anti-NATO he is, because these are things that he sees as somehow being damaging to the U.S. He sees NATO as being an organization which wants to sponge off on him. So Netanyahu is the antithesis to this, because he's the only world leader that Trump knew before he became, you know, before he entered politics, before his presidential race began. Trump knew Bibi back in the mid-80s when he was still a young-ish, up-and-coming real estate entrepreneur, and Netanyahu was the young and dashing ambassador to the UN, and they had mutual friends. Probably the most famous of their mutual friends was Ronald Lauder, now the president of the World Jewish Congress, at the time one of Netanyahu's earlier patrons and benefactors, and he introduced Donald Trump to Benjamin Netanyahu, and they had some kind of a friendship. They weren't very close, but they were, you know, they knew each other, and they've been in some kind of touch ever since. So on that morning in November 2016, after the surprising result of the U.S. presidential election, where leaders from around the world are trying to find a way to get through the Trump Tower switchboard and try and schedule a call with the newly elected president of the United States, there was one leader who didn't need that, and that was Netanyahu. And that's a huge advantage which no other world leader has. We've seen in the last two and a half years since Trump was elected how that has been significant.
And I mean, also the ambassadorial relationship is very significant, isn't it? I mean, the Israeli ambassador to Washington is also someone that knew the Trump circle early on and did a good job, I suppose, of getting in with the Trump crowd, you know, well before he was a serious contender for the presidency. So I guess, you know, when we're talking about ambassadors and, you know, the UK ambassador to Washington, certainly the Israeli ambassador to Washington, he already had a whole leg in the door, if you like.
Sure. Well, I mean, the US and Israel, unlike Britain, do have a tradition of ambassadors in major capitals not being professional civil servants, rather appointees of the president of the US or the prime minister of Israel. So Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador in Washington, has been called over the years Netanyahu's brain. He's not any ambassador. He's not any a representative. He's one of the very closest people to Netanyahu, and he's there in Washington, and he was there already during the Obama administration. He's there to represent Netanyahu more than he's there to represent even Israel. And he was close to a number of key members of the Trump circle before the election. Netanyahu himself wasn't so sure he wanted Trump to win the election. He was more interested in a more predictable kind of Republican. And Dermer was one of the people who tried to put Netanyahu's mind at ease by telling him that, you know, he would work well with the Trump people, and that obviously has proven to be true. But you didn't mention another ambassador. That's David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador.
Yeah.
And he's also not a classic diplomat, but he's a private lawyer. He's Donald Trump's bankruptcy lawyer, and there are few people in the world, probably no people in the world, who know more about Donald Trump's financial dealings than David Friedman. Friedman is extremely, extremely close to Trump, and we've been hearing over recent months that in that small group of Trump advisors on the Middle East, which includes Jared Kushner and David Greenblatt, that David Friedman is actually the closest of that group. And he has Trump's ear in many cases. He's more to the right wing than any of the others, quite right wing anyway, advisors. And he seems to have shifted policy in his direction. He's also supposed to be the first person that Trump hears in the morning. If Trump gets up early, when everyone else in Washington is asleep. So
the time difference works. So he's someone he can ring up and run.
Freeman is someone who you can call up because he's 7 hours ahead.
Yeah.
So we had this rather unique case in the history of diplomacy where two ambassadors who are really so close to the leaders of their country are in either country. Also, Dermer, born in America, religious, very much like Friedman. You have this really unique personal bond connecting the Netanyahu government to the Trump White House.
So I think what you were saying in your article this week is that it's so personal that it could very quickly unravel, and that if there were people that believe that sort of Trump has taken the Israel relationship to a new high, and that it's based on policy, then you know Israelis should think again, and you sort of paint a picture where, you know, if Bibi was no longer prime minister and someone like Ron Derman was no longer in Washington, then things could change drastically. I mean, do you really think that's true, or do you think that Trump will still be led by the evangelicals or others?
Well, you know, I didn't write drastically, but I do think that I think there would be a change because Trump takes everything personally. And we've seen in the tone of a couple of his tweets and remarks in the aftermath of the previous Israeli election in April, where he sort of seemed to be almost offended that the Israelis hadn't got their act together and formed a new Netanyahu government. And you can almost see Trump taking it personally if Netanyahu either loses the election or is forced out of office because of the indictments and the criminal investigations against him, which also in some ways mirror Trump's own problems. You can always see him taking it personally now. I'm not suggesting that he'll take it out on Israel, but it will certainly lower the warmth and the closeness of the relationship. Don't forget also that the people who are working on these issues, Friedman, and Kushner, and Greenblatt, are very right wing. Also, when it comes to Israel, if Israel were to have a more centrist government, they would be less in step with Israeli policies. I'd argue that Friedman is even to the right of Netanyahu in many ways. But I don't think necessarily that Trump will suddenly become anti-Israel because of that. But when Netanyahu says and makes a big deal of his relationship with Trump, he's not lying. That it is significant. I'm not saying this is the reason to vote Netanyahu. I don't vote Likud. I'm not intending to. And I don't think, and I don't see Trump as, now on a personal level, not as a political analyst, I don't think Trump is pro-Israel. I think Trump is leading Israel into a very disastrous corner. But there will certainly be a change in the tone of the relationship if Netanyahu leaves while Trump is still president, because Trump, that's how Trump views the world. Trump was going to, was threatening to nuke North Korea until he actually met Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-un charmed him. And we've seen this bizarre way of Trump conducting foreign policy with nothing to do with American interests. He's so friendly towards Russia because Putin somehow is his role model and a strong man. And it's the same thing with Netanyahu. I don't see him getting along that well with any other Israeli president, prime minister, just because he doesn't know any other Israeli politicians.
Yeah, it's very personal. Yeah, and the tone could change very quickly. Well, that's a fascinating argument and really good to discuss that with you, Anshul. So thank you so much for joining us.
And that's all for this week. For our listeners, if you are enjoying the Bicon podcast, then I would ask you to review us on iTunes or even send us comments about what you'd like to hear more of and more guests you'd like to hear. Thank you very much for listening.